Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Food insecurity has been an issue long before the pandemic, but the pandemic pushed food banks to feed even more people. The nonprofit Projections from Feeding America shows that this year, 1 in 8 people will experience food insecurity. So it's someone you know. When the pandemic first began, Insight spoke with a few food banks throughout the region and found they were desperately in need of volunteers to help out and were running out of food. But of course, there was a predicament. With even more people seeking out food, they became overwhelmed with a lack of volunteers to prevent the spread of COVID-19. So we're going to take some time this morning to check in and talk about what food insecurity looks like in Sacramento and Northern Nevada now. Joining us is Melanie Flood with the Sacramento Food Bank. We last spoke last November. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is Nicole Lamboli with the Food Bank of Northern Nevada. Nicole was last on the show in April of 2020. A lot has changed. Welcome to Insight, Nicole.
Thank you.
Well, Melanie, starting with you, I mean, we got big news with the annual event, Run to Feed the Hungry. But before we get to that, you know, there's still a financial toll from the pandemic. How is that translating into food insecurity in Sacramento County?
So food insecurity was an issue for Sacramento County before the pandemic began. What many people don't know, you know, we're the food bank for Sacramento County for the region, but what many people don't know is that our numbers were higher for hunger than state and national averages before this pandemic even began. So, you know, we were seeing about 150,000 clients a month before the pandemic started. And that quickly rose at the height of the pandemic to 300,000 people.
That's double.
So double at the height of the pandemic. And what we know from 2008, you know, during the recession, that those numbers never went back down. So we're serving more and more clients who have never had to utilize a food program before. And then we're looking towards sustainability through the future, knowing that we'll be serving these people for many, many, many years to come.
You know, I want to touch upon what you said before the pandemic, that Sacramento County's rates were actually higher than country or state averages when it came to food insecurity. Why is that?
Well, it's really because, you know, there was a gap in the number of people we were reaching. So basically, we were reaching about 150,000 people a month through our network of partner agencies that we partner with to serve these people. But at the time, the food insecurity numbers were about 215,000 people. You know, so at that time, there was a gap of around 65,000 people that we weren't serving. And at that time, we were putting out around 28 million pounds of food pre-COVID, which equates to around 23 million meals. So then during COVID, that grew exponentially. We were serving 38 million pounds of food, which equates to 32 million meals. And when you think about something like that, that can really break the system. And so when people were told to stay at home, a lot of our partner agencies were run by volunteers and those people that were at risk. And a lot of those volunteers are retired. So we had to bring in the National Guard. They did an incredible job. But, you know, at the end of the day, we look at our organization and we worry about sustainability and we don't see the numbers going down. So, it's concerning.
Yeah, Melanie, I actually visited the food bank during that time, during the pandemic, when the National Guard was there and just the challenges of not having the volunteers that you normally have, given that, you know, a good amount, as you mentioned, are retirees. You know, logistically, it was just even visually just very different. What were the learning lessons from that time, especially when you're really hitting home sustainability and this is not a sprint, it's a marathon?
So I think the biggest thing we took away, well, what I first like to say is we love our volunteers. I mean, we wouldn't be an organization without our volunteer force. And we've got about 11,000 people that help us. And we're immensely grateful for all of them. I think a lot of the learning lessons we took away from that was looking at who we could partner with in our community that could help us build upon the small amount of resources we had at the time. For example, paratransit is something that a partnership that was a very positive thing that came out of the pandemic. We partnered with them to reach seniors that were isolated and also people with disabilities. We partnered with school districts in Sacramento County to reach not only children, but their families as well, because a lot of children who are on free and reduced lunch, especially if you look at our food bank campus, and you look at Robles School District, that is right where our food bank campus is, off of Bell Avenue, you will see that 94% of the children there are on free or reduced lunch. So the need is already great. So when we partnered with school districts, we wanted to make sure that we also could help feed their families as well. Because a lot of those programs, you can't send a box of food home for the parents, but the parents might not be working and they're hungry too, or they might be skipping meals to make sure that their children are fed. So a lot of wonderful partnerships have come out of the pandemic, which we are going to continue moving forward.
Yeah, and the SAC Food Bank is essentially a hub for a lot of food pantries really across the county. It's pretty impressive. Can you just help us visualize how that works?
Yeah, so we are the food bank for the county. So every county has a food bank. We're a partner distribution organization of Feeding America, as you mentioned. And how we work is we're a spoke and wheel model. So you can kind of think of us as being like a bank of food. And people, and we're kind of the wholesaler and the retailer, the food pantries and the food closets and the food agencies and the churches and the charities, they come to us and they make withdrawals. So they pick up food and then we send food out to our community through those agencies. So those partnerships are of utmost importance to us. And we want to make sure that we reach people in areas that we call food deserts, areas that people don't have access to healthy and nutritious food.
Well, on to good news. A Thanksgiving tradition is back. So just get us up to speed about Run to Feed the Hungry. And, you know, we know how it helps the community. But last year it was virtual. I actually covered it. And, you know, it was such a different feeling. I mean, it was great to just get out there and do the best that everyone could. But I think there's just a lot of excitement that this tradition is coming back in person.
Yeah, so Run to Feed the Hungry, we're back and we're better than ever. We're super excited to be able to bring the event back to the community. This is our 28th year of doing the event. Yes, we did have to go virtual last year due to COVID, but we're super excited that we're able to open registration and welcome our community back after, you know, everybody's had a really tough over a year now. It's been almost a year and a half. So what I do want to reiterate is we care the most about keeping our community safe. So there have been a lot of questions around, you know, are there going to be specific guidelines and such? We are following the CDC and local officials very closely, their guidelines, and we will follow any guidelines that they put out. So we want our community to be safe, but we also want them to participate. And I do want everyone to know that we are offering the virtual option as well again. So if people don't feel comfortable going out to a race with a bunch of people, or if they already have a commitment to cook dinner for their family, they can absolutely register for the run.
Yeah, so you're just going to have to stay nimble, as we all have been over the last 17 months.
Absolutely. But we're really looking forward to it. And we welcome adults. We welcome youth, teams. You know, we're open to everything and everyone. And runtofeedthehungry.com is where you can find out all of the information about what we do. And it does bring a lot of money to our organization, which is really important. It raises nearly $1 million. And we use that money directly to help our community. So what I do want to reiterate as well is $1, every time someone gives $1 to our organization, it equals 5 meals for a family. So if you feel like you can't make a difference, you absolutely can. $1, 5 meals.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with the food bank of a Sacramento food bank. And now we're going to speak with the Food Bank of Northern Nevada. Nicole, the last time you were on Insight was April of 2020. And obviously, you were continuing to see an increased need. What does it look like now in Northern Nevada?
Well, clearly, thank you again for having us. We do cover parts of Northern California as well and partner with so many of our sister food banks in California to meet the need. And just like Melanie said, we are continuing to see increased numbers. The issue of hunger in our communities was on the rise even before the pandemic, and really what the pandemic showed was that there was a significant need. And for those people, when I was on last April, we saw basically a 30% increase overnight. Those numbers declined a little bit, but we are still, for the last fiscal year, tracking higher than we did the prior fiscal year by, we're serving about 107,000 people per month. In our service territory, which covers 90,000 square miles, including portions of 8 counties in California.
Wow. What is the greatest need that you're seeing and the greatest challenges that you're seeing in your area? Because I imagine it looks different from one food bank region to another.
There are a lot of differences, but there are also similarities. High housing costs have really squeezed household budgets. When people are housing insecure or have unstable housing, that obviously creates enormous impacts. But also just being able to make ends meet and cover basic household expenses is very difficult for people. So what we find is that, you know, they need to seek emergency food assistance to meet their household food needs. And it's particularly high towards the end of the month. And the cost of food has really gone up for families and individuals. In some markets, it's up 28%, and various products are either costly or very difficult to get. So when we kind of started looking at our populations, you know, there's several groups of people who have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. Those include service industry workers, where, you know, who rely on tourism and entertainment and recreation and visitors to support the community. When everything shut down, all of a sudden they lost income. And so they didn't have the ability to work from home or seek other means of support. We also see an impact on seniors who aren't leaving their homes. Just as many seniors were unable to volunteer, those in need had, you know, compromised health conditions and often stayed home, and reaching them and trying new models of distribution so that we could meet their food needs were really important. And then children 0 to 5 are greatly impacted. As Melanie mentioned, many of us work hand in hand with our local school districts, and we have a way of reaching school-age children, but often it's hard to get to those households that may have children who are not yet school age. And so we're really looking at new ways to reach those populations.
Over the last 17 months, have there been some moments or exchanges that you've had that just stick with you when it comes to food insecurity?
That at any time, any of us could be vulnerable. And I think that's what we learned. And so many of our community members learned. I think across the country, if you talk any food bank staff person that you talk to, they really feel the generosity and the support that they received from the local community about how do we address the needs. We had volunteers who found themselves suddenly without income and needed emergency food assistance. We have heard stories where, you know, people are working, but there's just things that they can't quite afford. And so they feel the need to have to be blended into this giant population of people who are food insecure. And we are a country of resources of food. And one of the biggest challenges, as I think our colleague at the Sacramento Food Bank pointed out, is how do we get, you know, this food to those communities that are underserved, and access for them and fill those gaps. And we're thinking hard about that. And it's really being nimble and agile. If there is a light about the pandemic, it's that people started to think differently and really dig deep as to how we could meet the needs of our community members.
Given that we're in the middle of wildfire season, and I know that some people who were evacuated from wildfires actually traveled to northern Nevada because they had to evacuate their area, and that impacts so many communities, some of which the Food Bank of Northern Nevada serves. So how are you addressing the needs of wildfire survivors and evacuees?
Yeah, we are partnering with our local agencies. For instance, tomorrow, Thursday, we are doing special distributions up in the Susanville area for those families and households that were affected by the fire. You know, in Susanville, they had not only the fire impacts, but then they lost power. So many households did not even have, you know, if they did have food, they lost their food because the refrigeration went out or they only had power for a few hours. So we're working with the Food Bank of Contra Costa and Solano County to make sure that we're getting food resources into those communities, not only from an emergency standpoint, but how do we do it, you know, as they recover. And so we partner together with everybody to say, what are the needs? You know, in some cases, it's just prepared meals for those who are at an evacuation site. But as people return to their homes, oftentimes, you know, they don't know where to start. And so our partner agencies are really the key to connecting with those community members.
And that's just really incredible that you can partner with counties that are, you know, in the Bay Area and you're based in Northern Nevada.
Well, we've all faced, you know, challenges with food resources. The supply chain has been challenging. You know, there's a lot of things that without partnering with our partner agencies, we have 147 in our service area. But, you know, then we have 200 food banks and PDOs, as the Sacramento Food Bank indicated they are, that really help us connect. And we work together because feeding people is our core mission. And we want to make sure that no one goes to bed hungry and that they know where the resources are when they need them.
Nicole and Bellamy, thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you for
having us. Thank you so much for having us.
Sacramento Food Bank Director of Communications Melanie Flood and President and CEO of the Food Bank of Northern Nevada, Nicole Lamboli. Up next, Sacramento County received another round of pandemic recovery funding. We'll hear from community organizers about where that money is most needed. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The American Rescue Plan Act provided federal funds to state, local, and tribal governments to help with pandemic recovery. The federal funds are meant to be used as a support towards COVID-19 response efforts, from public health to repairing the local economy. When Sacramento County first received CARES Act funds last year for pandemic response, there was an outcry from some residents and community groups because a majority of the funds were allocated to the Sheriff's Department ahead of public health. This time around, the county will receive over $300 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds. The county did ask residents to submit their suggestions. They did a survey as to how that money should be spent. So now I want to bring in Genoa Barrow. She is a senior staff writer for the Sacramento Observer, who's been following this story very closely. Ms. Barrow, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Ms. Gonzalez. Thank you for having me.
Well, the Sacramento Observer is nearly 60 years old. It is a Black-owned newspaper serving the African-American community. How instrumental was the Sacramento Observer during this unprecedented time that really ripped open existing inequities?
The key word is existing, and COVID sort of exposed some of the disparities that, you know, our community has been experiencing for some time. And so we just believe it is our job to showcase and bring to light things that are affecting our community. And this obviously was one of them.
What are the biggest changes you're seeing in those communities since March of 2020? I mean, 17 months ago, when everything just effectively shut down.
COVID has changed everything. And at the beginning, you know, we were using the terms, you know, return to normal, new normal. And I don't think we've gotten there quite yet. But it's impacted, you know, every aspect of our lives. And like I said, you know, it exposed disparities that, you know, we've been waving our hand and saying, hey, you know, this is our lives. This is our reality. And unfortunately, some folks have ignored that. And so we're saying now, and the community is saying now, you know, even with COVID, it's like we're not going to, you know, lay down and just, you know, continue to suffer silently.
When you first began following Sacramento County's COVID relief spending from federal funds, you obtained documents that showed the county used a sizable amount to cover correctional costs. Can you explain what that included?
Okay, yeah. We had what you would call a whistleblower. Obviously, you know, sometimes we have the saying, you know, what's done in the dark comes to light. It did. And like you said, the county executives gave the bulk of the CARES Act funds to corrections, and the bulk of that went to the sheriff's department. And it was like, it was like 90% went to, a little bit over 90% went to corrections. And of, I think it was like 150 million, 104 went to sheriff's department. It was like administrative days off, salaries and benefits.
And not public health.
And not public health. And public health was given like it was a small amount. And so once it came out, the reasoning was they were trying to balance the budget and they had a certain amount of time in order to, you know, clear the budget. And so they used what money they had at hand. I they just didn't expect anyone to notice that it had been done. And some people say, oh, it's done all the time. You have to do this, you have to do that. And then it was almost like the community was being chastised for calling it out. You know, oh, you do want public safety. You do want the sheriffs, you will do, you know. And it's like, I think it was demonstrated by the large number of the hundreds of people who called in to the county meetings, wrote in, and obviously during COVID, there wasn't in-person meetings. So, you know, everybody had to do either, you know, call in or write in. But I think the community spoke and said, you know, no, we're not taking this. And then not only that, but the public health officials had to then almost beg to get money for the things that were needed, and that just wasn't acceptable.
So with all of that in hindsight, what are you focusing on now as the county is poised to receive another round of federal recovery funding? I mean, we're talking over $300 million this time from the American Rescue Plan Act, which was signed by President Biden.
And Mr. Hewitt and the other members of the coalition that wrote that open letter, demanding inclusion and diversity, they can speak to those priorities. But we will continue, as the community members are saying, we'll continue to watch it. We'll continue to report on it, because I think the public has a right to know. And the community has said, you know, time and time again, we want to be included. We want to be seen, even before included. We want to be seen and heard. And they don't want to go, you know, it's $300 million over 2 years. We don't want to get to the end of the 2 years and say, once again, our needs aren't met. So we'll continue as a a voice, amplifying the community has its own voice, but an entity and a newspaper edifying, amplifying the community voice will continue to do that.
And we're going to have those local organizations joining us in just a few minutes. But from what you're gathering as a journalist serving your community, is there some optimism that the money is going to go towards those hardest hit, given that now, obviously, a light was shown on how it was spent last year, and now there's a community survey? So it seems to be that there's some remedies that the county is imposing to spend the money in a way that is appropriate for residents throughout the county.
Again, I will continue to watch it. And I think also continuing to cover it and show that, you know, the community, that there are people watching and expecting and holding you accountable to what, you know, you say you're going to do. It's one thing to say equity exists and access, you know, to the funds are there, but you have to, I mean, you have to put your money where your mouth is, I mean, quite literally. And so I think we'll continue to watch. We're optimistic, just like community members spoke to me from who signed the letter. They're optimistic, but you're optimistic and you're realistic at the same time. And so we've seen, you know, people give, you know, lip service to things. And we're just hopeful that, you know, they know that folks are watching and expecting. And I mean, it's like, I don't think that people are totally blind to, you know, the needs of the community. It's whether or not those are made priority remains to be seen.
Finally, we are far from, you know, as you said from the very beginning, normal, whatever that is. You know, it's almost frustrating to hear the word normal now. What are you focusing on in the weeks and months ahead as we are having rising cases and we have stalled vaccination rates? When you're listening to people throughout the county, what are your overarching concerns?
Overarching concerns, you know, the number of people in our community that remain unvaccinated is high, you know, and now we're getting obviously a rising number of people who are vaccinated and still are getting, you know, with the Delta variant. And I keep reminding people when I talk to people, there are several variants. The Delta one is just the, you know, the most prevalent right now. And I have I've been covering the pandemic since it started. And at the end of this month, we'll be launching a series that I'm doing on vaccination equity. And it's in partnership. I'm a 2021 fellow, California fellow with USC Center of Health Journalism. And we'll be launching a 3-part series on vaccination equity. So I've been watching closely those numbers and the community driven efforts to get the vaccine to the folks that need it most.
We'll have to bring you on for that. And I actually was a 2018 fellow with USC's Center for Health Journalism. It's a great program. Awesome. So I look forward to having you back on, Ms. Barrow.
Yes, my fellowship sister.
Yes, exactly. We could chat about it once it's completed. Senior staff writer for the Sacramento Observer, Genoa Barrow. Well, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a new round of federal COVID recovery funds awarded to Sacramento County. So we're going to shift the conversation to some of the community organizations who, just as Ms. Barrow said, signed a letter that was sent to Sacramento County Board of Supervisors. Joining us now is Chet Hewitt with the Sierra Health Foundation, Kim Williams with the Sacramento Building Healthy Communities, and Kathy Rodriguez from the Sacramento Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Welcome all to Insight.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, Chet, let's start with you. Just tell us about the coalition, who's involved, and how did this get started?
But a coalition is a reconvening of a coalition that was formerly called the Cares for the People Coalition, working along with the People's Budget Coalition that formed in the summer of 2020 in response to the CARES Act dilemma, in which 70% of the resources were actually targeted towards law enforcement. That group has come back together and actually expanded and is now focusing on how the American Rescue Plan Act dollars the $300 million you referenced are going to be spent here in Sacramento County. Our goal is, you know, simple, to be very proactive, to watch what's going on, to really give voice and to amplify the aspirations of communities, particularly communities of color, who have disproportionately borne the brunt of COVID impact. And clearly we know that's around mortality, illness, and even mortality, death. But we also know that the social, economic, physical, and emotional impacts have been disproportionately distributed in those communities as well. So our goal is to strongly assist the county to do what's right, to do what's best, and to use the resources in community to do it extraordinarily well.
Kim, you're with Sacramento Building Healthy Communities. Why was it important for your organization to be part of this coalition? And what do you want the letter to the board to accomplish?
Thank you. So for Building Healthy Communities, we've been working for the last 10 years, and health equity has been the foundation of our work. And we've been really concerned about folks in our communities that are really uninvested in, have had many, many challenges. And so when the CARES funding came out last year and we saw what happened and where those dollars were going, and once again, an opportunity for the county to really step up and do some impactful, innovative things in our communities, they didn't do that. And then when this opportunity came this time, we were definitely a part of this group because we realized that we have the opportunity to make some significant changes and have some significant impact. And those dollars have to come into the community. And we wanted to be at the table with our other CBOs to say, hey, county, you've got to do the right thing by our communities. And you've got to serve the people who are most in need with this opportunity at this time.
Kathy, you're with the Sacramento Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And when we think about the pandemic and the toll on businesses, I think a lot of times it's easy to just focus on the city center, right? Like Midtown and downtown. But there are so many businesses and small businesses outside of that immediate area. What stays with you over the last 17 months when you're talking with businesses within the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in terms of the challenges and maybe being overlooked?
That it wasn't something new. That was the hard part, right? So I think everyone is saying that what we found in this pandemic is things just rose to the top. And we already knew where inequities were, where underinvestment was. But with the pandemic, it was just so hard hitting that it just became, I think everyone finally got to see the light on it. And we all love the Central City. I want to be clear about that. You know, having a dynamic urban core is, you know, vital to all of us. And we have members that are there too. But our corridors that have been historically underinvested and under-resourced, what I share with a lot of people is if you go out into these neighborhoods, we have businesses that have been there for generations. And that means they've been the anchor in these neighborhoods. So in past recessions that have happened when everything else closed down, they were actually the tax base for the city. They were the ones that were keeping everyone together. And the same for the county. And here was something happened, and we can see where if investment had been made then, where would we be now? And so now we have these relief funds that came through the CARES and the new ones that are coming. And that's a key word. It was relief. It was supposed to be to really assist those that needed it the most, to go out into these areas and really provide that technical assistance, that planning that they needed to really make sure that they could stay viable and open. And a lot of things that we saw, and the reason that this coalition is so important and we wanted to be a part of it, is that things as simple as they needed to be in language, that they need to be in culture. They need to hear from trusted resources what the options are for them. And so a lot of times things would come out, and we're all guilty of it. I include myself in it too. You know, using social media, using email blasts, and not realizing some people didn't have that technology. So they're missing out on all this information that's going out. And we're assuming we're sending these daily things out. Everyone should know. And they're not. They don't have that technology. And so those were things that really, you know, shot to the top. And so for our businesses who were like, well, I do need a loan. I didn't know that this was coming, or I didn't know how to apply for it. And so we had, you know, boots on the ground out there that were helping people with a laptop, you know, wearing masks, being social distance, but helping people fill out these applications, you know, doing repeat visits, really being that community organization, business organization that was, you know, doing that work. So we ended up being an extension of a lot of the programming that was happening through the county. And so that's why we're here, you know, to let you know that we are here to be partners with you. We want to work with you. This funding that's coming in, as Kim mentioned, it's an opportunity to really invest in these areas and make a difference. And so if you're intentional about it and really listen to the community and what their needs are and develop the programs and bring the programming that's really going to help them elevate, this can be a game changer for so many people and for the communities at large. And that's what we're really saying is we're coming together collectively as one voice. And I think that you can agree that it's really hard to say, well, we're going to, you know, not listen to this one group because they're so loud. But when you have, you know, 78 coming together, that's a pretty loud voice. And we're all saying that we know that you can do the right thing. We know that you care about the community or you won't be in these positions there. But we really want to be that partner with you and help you make the decisions that are really best for the community, the things the community is asking for. So, you know, that's why we're here.
Well, we did reach out to Sacramento County and we did receive an emailed statement from interim county executive Ann Edwards. And essentially it was saying that, you know, following the community survey, that the county's funding priorities line up fairly well with the letter that was sent from your coalition. And those funding priorities are supporting public health, serving low income communities, premium pay for essential workers, replacing public sector revenue that was lost during the pandemic, as well as investing in water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure. The next step is developing a spending plan, and the county is committed to staying true to the priorities from the community survey. Is that reassuring to you? And I guess I guess we'll end with all of that with all of you, and let's start with Chet in just the last couple minutes that we have.
Well, a couple of things that I would say Vicki. There is some alignment between, you know, the top three priorities that come out of the Deloitte study, which is housing, homelessness, and health. And of course, our priorities articulated in a letter signed by, as Kathy said, 78 community leaders, business, faith, medical health experts, as well as community leaders as well, is health equity, support for homelessness, economic development for families and minority-owned businesses, and youth services. We want an explicit focus on our young people. We know how important it is. You'll have kids who are going to the second grade who've never been in school before. So we know we're facing some really unique challenges. Kids who will enter the 10th grade who've never been to high school before. We want to be really focused on supporting those who have been deeply impacted and need to recover from the effects of the pandemic. It is a recovery plan act. It is designed for recovery. With respect to the survey done by Deloitte, 1,500 responses, and as someone who runs a foundation that has pretty good community reach, have not been able to identify a single community group that responded or was contacted. The response also has no demographic or geographic data. We don't know which communities respondents actually came from. So we can't tell whose voice is really being considered. And while I don't want to force the kind of suspicion or accuse people of not doing things well, we know based on past experience that there is a level of data that's going to be very important to ensure that the priorities that have been articulated are really representative of the hopes and aspirations of those who have been most impacted. The last thing I'll say, I think this is really, really important. Categories themselves don't define the approach you use to address an issue. So we think many of the strategies to support businesses, support families, to support communities needs to come through community-based organizations so that the impact that Kathy articulated about not knowing, not gaining access, not hearing about till money is spent does not happen again. Authentic messengers employed to do authentic Recovery Act work. And our coalition is about demanding by being supportive and offering assistance, not just complaining, that it not only be done well, but it also be done in a way that is focused and inclusive of the things that were called out in that plan around racial equity, inclusion, and a focus on those who are most impacted. So with those things, we are in total agreement.
Kim, with just about a minute or so left, anything else you'd like to add?
Chet covered that very well. Yes, we are, you know, we were pleased to see that the some of the priority areas definitely overlapped, and those are extremely important. I would just add to that is, you know, while the priorities overlap, because the study, because we don't know demographics and we don't know who participated in this survey and the concern about the voices that have been left out, what the survey doesn't show us is, you know, the equity piece. It doesn't show us the communities that have been most impacted. And so the priorities are wonderful, but in our letter, we were very clear about where these dollars should go and who these dollars should go to. And the survey is not clear on that. And so our concern is really going to be making sure those resources get to the right places and to the right communities. And so really wanting to be able to make sure that we can call up the racial equity that needs to be put in place, the inclusion, and making sure we targeted those programs and the funds go to those most impacted by COVID.
Thank you all for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Don't you love Zoom? Chet Hewitt is with the Sierra Health Foundation, Kim Williams with Sacramento Building Healthy Communities, and Kathy Rodriguez with the Sacramento Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Still ahead, a conversation about anxiety that some children may be experiencing as they prepare for a return to the classroom. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Coping with the pandemic is hard for all of us. Sometimes just getting out of bed is difficult. I mean, the stress, uncertainty, frustration, and isolation is just simply tough. Overall, the pandemic has put a lot of pressure on all of us, and kids and teens especially. So joining us now to help us understand anxiety in adolescents and some ways parents can step in and help is Dr. Don Blacker, Associate Director of Mental Health Services at UC Davis Children's Hospital. Dr. Blacker, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How has your role in mental health for children evolved over the pandemic?
That's a great question. You know, fortunately for us, so we're part of the Department of Pediatrics at the Care Center, and we had already implemented using telehealth as an option to provide mental health services a year prior to COVID hitting. So we had, you know, had already been introduced with that to our clinicians as well as our clients. And so we were fortunate, very fortunate to not have a steep learning curve in providing those services via telehealth. So in that regard, we weren't as impacted as say other agencies. We're definitely seeing a significant increase in youth who may not normally be experiencing anxiety. So we're seeing an increase in referrals of clients who are either struggling with, you know, being in remote learning for a year and that impact, as well as the impact and exposure to concerns that parents may have related to the pandemic and how that spills over into their children.
Yeah, I mean, a year of distance learning. I mean, you know, we hear and we know that children are resilient, but that is just grueling. That's so tough. I mean, were there some stories or moments with families and children that resonate with you?
Yeah, and I think it's important to recognize that our experience is that there's a group of kids that did really well with distant learning and are actually going to have a hard time going back to in-person learning. And those are more of those introverted children, maybe more prone to social anxiety. So they're like, I'm good. This is great for me. That being said,
there's adults like that too with working
exactly
from home, understandably
don't want to go back to work in person. But I think that's a smaller percentage. I think overall, the majority of the kids who were doing remote learning, it was pretty impactful in not a positive way, particularly the younger kids. That's much harder. because of attention span, sort of just the format of how the learning was conducted. And then for the adolescents who are more social or, and more extroverted, plus we know adolescents, peer support is very, very important for social and mental health functioning. And so not having that was very, very significant. And so we saw a lot of that. So just in terms of stories, there's a really, we do see clients in the clinic. We did see clients in the clinic. So about 40, 50% of our clients are seen in the clinic now, and then the rest are seen via telehealth. But there was one little story when we started to see clients back in the clinic after the shutdown, the first shutdown. There was a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old, and it was clear that they had not been around other peers in a while, and they ran into each other outside the rooms, and they were like just enthralled to see another human being that was their age. Yeah. And they gave each other a hug. So you could see where it was just that, you know, that desire and drive to communicate or interact with others, even at such a young age, is very powerful. And it was also sort of poignant because it was sort of the loss that they had because they weren't able to be in person in school.
Yeah, I think a lot of us can remember the first time we actually hugged someone and, you know, after months of, you know, kind of, you know, being distant for safety. You know, just kind of closing, finally, as a parent, what should they be mindful of, or just a loved one, an adult, a teacher, just someone who cares about children, what should they be mindful of as we round the corner to back to school and really a change in routine?
So I think there's a couple things. One is to recognize that there's going to be a roller coaster of emotions and ways that the children may be having. You know, there may be one day that they're very excited about returning, and then the next day it's really challenging and hard. The other thing I think as caregivers and parents is to recognize that, you know, children, our children are very sensitive to how we are feeling, you know, and I think, you know, having us be in a state of mind that we are not, you know, anxious or freaking out about something, but, you know, providing information and being mindful where we are sort of mentally is also important. And then I think just checking in, like, how is it going? How is the feeling? Not like, how was your day? Because most kids are going to say, oh, it was fine. And they can't remember the thousands of things that happen. But like, how are things going for you? And then listening to them and seeing what they may possibly need, you know, and then just a small plug for, you know, hopefully giving them some coping skills. So mindfulness is a great strategy. You know, being able to identify the feelings that you're experiencing, and then what are some of the cognitive coping messages that we can give to our kids also can be helpful.
In the last, you know, 30 seconds to a minute or so that we have left, I think it's important to just really explain the difference between anxiety and nervousness, because you have, like, you know, maybe someone will think like, oh, they just got a little nerves. And that could actually trivialize like genuine anxiety, which is different that a child may be feeling.
Yeah. And so I think when you're thinking, so nervousness would, you know, the butterflies that you have for the first day of school. And then once you get there, it's fine. When you're talking about anxiety, you're talking about sort of longer impacting or more severe impactful. So, you know, sleep is disrupted. There could be somatic issues, headaches, stomach aches, those types of things. So if your children are experiencing those symptoms, then you might want to think about the benefit of therapy or counseling for them.
Thank you so much for spending time with us, Dr. Blacker.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me.
And we do have a link to some more tools from UC Davis Children's Hospital on our website at capradio.org/insight. And Dr. Don Blacker is the Associate Director of Mental Health Services at UC Davis Children's Hospital. Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or really wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.